Hello, 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 and welcome to the local edition on this Friday evening. I'm your host, Patricio Robayo. You doing well? In the second half of the show, we'll talk to a writer incarcerated at Sing Sing who has recently received one of the country's most prestigious literary awards, the Guggenheim. We'll talk to John J. Lennon as he discusses his historic Guggenheim Fellowship and growing recognition of prison journalism. But first, I don't know if you've noticed out there, it's kind of smoky. Wildfire smoke from Canada has once again moved into New York recently, bringing hazy skies and raising concerns about the air that we breathe. State officials have issued air quality advisories this week as fine particle pollution spread across the region. But what exactly is in wildfire smoke? And how can it affect our lungs and heart? And how do we know when it's safe to stay indoors? Joining us now is Dr. Yoki Mwaramba, who is a professor at the Empire State University. She's assistant professor of emergency management. So welcome to the program, doctor.
Thank you very much.
Yes. So, you know, with these wildfires, you know, we've been having a lot of these state officials have issued air quality advisories this week because of the fine particle pollution that's been spreading across our area because of the Canadian wildfires. Let's just talk about first about the actual smoke that's contained. What is actually contained in wildfire smoke?
Patricia, thank you for the question. As wildfire smoke, we know for certain, contains different kinds of particles. And because what's burning is debris from forests and also some debris from the structures that are being burnt, you can, through different identification systems and indexes, determine the kind of pollutants that are in the air quality, in the air, okay? So typically, the dangerous part here is that it's the size, with a wildfire, it's the size of the particulate pollutant that can be very dangerous to our health. So while we might not be too concerned if it isn't, you know, about the chemicals that might be in the air, say, for example, if it was an industrial burn, the major concern for us in as far as a public health approach goes is really the size of the pollutant and the danger to our health and our bodies and that of our pets as well.
And this is that's what I hear a lot about these particles, you know, like the smallest particle known as PM2.5. Just explain a little bit why is that so concerning?
Again, with that measure, and I'm glad you bring it up, Patricio, is that that is a measure that indicates the size of the particle. Mm. Okay. And at that point, it's the kind of particle that you might not necessarily see or know that you are inhaling, but you are indeed inhaling. And the challenge there is that when you inhale that particle and it ends up in your lungs, it very easily then can also get into your bloodstream and in the process affect your health, not just your lungs, but throughout your body. Mm-hmm. So that is the significance of that particle at that point.
So yeah, let's talk about that because, you know, like today we're recording this on Friday. Today's a little better in our area compared to yesterday. Yesterday, you know, almost the sun was blocked out almost just because of the smoke. And, you know, some people here in our office were complaining about, you know, the eye irritants and just smelling of this smoke. So what happens inside the body when we breathe in these particles?
So like I said, what happens with our bodies when we breathe in these particles is that certainly if, for example, you're a person who is already predisposed to a sensitive condition or you are vulnerable, you know, your health, you have some health vulnerabilities, you realize too that also on the indexes, when you're looking at air quality indexes, they demarcate for people who have sensitive conditions, for example, right? And those are people who are supposed to take precautions much earlier. So people who already have a predisposed condition are likely to get those conditions, for example, respiratory conditions, it could be asthma, they could get very quickly aggravated. And I'd also like to highlight that also for people who are elderly, people who are expecting children or young children could also be significantly disposed or predisposed to aggravated health conditions. And then for us, to who, for the people who might not necessarily be in the significant category, again, you still do want to mitigate the possible health impacts of these particles getting into your bloodstream and conditions that could then affect your health. Again, ranging anywhere from respiratory conditions to other health, poor health.
Right.
And mainly affecting your breathing, you know, affecting your breathing. It's really something that you want to mitigate, whether you belong to a sensitive group or not, but certainly taking precedence for the sensitive group members of our community.
Now, I like to go for morning walks, early morning walks. And yesterday, yes, I went for my morning walk, but I took my mask with me. I took it out from the pandemic days. And I have a K95 mask. And how much protection does the N95 or the KN95 mask actually provide?
You did well to not only pick up a mask, but certainly the encouragement is to pick up an N95 or K95 mask and to make sure that it is very securely placed over your mouth and your nose area. And the protection here, again, it's mitigation. So if someone really does have to go outside, and we have to also be sympathetic to the people whose jobs take them outside, right? Because we really don't necessarily have policies protecting outdoor workers that are as effective as they should be, is that the mask does help impede the possibility or the amount of particle inhalation. But that can also protect you up to a certain level. Taking the mask plus making sure that you keep up with the information that is being put out by either the Emergency Management Office or Public Health, or looking at the air quality indexes to make sure that you're even supposed to be outside, is what is the most effective way of making a decision on whether to, for example, even go outside, or whether you should go outside and wear an N95 mask protectively put over and tightly put over your mouth and nose or not. So it's not just one thing when it comes to making a decision about whether to go outside or not. It really does require for us to look at multiple data points that are available to the public. And the air quality index certainly does come in handy, and listening to local officials and also, you know, just looking outside and making an assessment as an individual to determine, you know, what your thinking is. So there's a multiplicity of triangulation that needs to happen in this decision-making process.
Yeah, and just in driving, I know one of the recommendations I've heard was to use the recycling air in the car, so you don't have that air outside. So how about inside the home? How can people improve the air inside their homes during these times?
I think that's the other thing, too, is yes, even if you're driving, use recycled air. And in the homes, too, it's trying to make sure that your air quality is optimal for what you can afford or what you have. There are, for example, recommendations to make sure that your doors and your windows are really tightly shut as possible. We are in the summer, so if you therefore can do that without predisposing yourself to overheating, then for sure that's the one thing that you can do and it'd be sufficient. However, if you really do need air conditioning as well, because the temperatures are much higher and unbearable, then there's multiple options. There's shelters for those people that cannot afford the air conditioning that could be available in different jurisdictions depending on what, you know, what the plans are. And again, that is why it's important to keep up with the local emergency management offices or public health to make sure that this information is out there. But in the house too, the air conditioning is important, but trying to make sure that you do not have external air intake into the home as well. That too is important to consider. Again, cannot emphasize enough just the triangulation of information and data points, which is, again, available to the public. Mm-hmm. And there's always, you know, a place that you can call to get clarity on that.
Yeah. Now, if folks are having symptoms, you know, what symptoms should mean someone could, you know, should be contacting a doctor or seek emergency care?
Great question, because this is certainly dependent upon, you know, health prior to these experiences. Some people, like I said, the people who are more sensitive to pollution, certainly their trigger points are very different from those that do not necessarily have different pre-existing conditions. So knowing for them, knowing what it is that their doctors have recommended that they use as a metric that determines a decision to go seek emergency help is very important. So having that conversation with your doctor is important because this is, it's becoming more frequent that we have this kind of air pollution, right? So having this conversation with your doctor so that you're pre-informed is important because then you can know based on your health conditions when it is that you need to take a next step and what that next step could be. Certainly, for everyone across the board, if your breathing is impeded, dry throat, itchy eyes, then you have to decide, make a call on what it is that you need. And calling a medical team or deciding whether to go to an urgent care or emergency room then becomes something that also has to be negotiated depending on the access that you have to a medical support, or whether it's something that you can do virtually. That's yet another option that people can use. And a virtual call can also help you determine whether you really do need, again, to go outside and expose yourself once again to additional pollutants in the air if, you know, you have to go by bus or if you have to drive there. You know, so all these are different decisions that have to be made at different points. But if it's affecting your breathing, your sight is getting quite affected, I think it's certainly important to make those calls. And to keep an eye on children and people with disabilities that cannot express themselves necessarily, but being able to see and identify if they're struggling at a point is also important for us to keep an eye on. And pets, keeping an eye on our pets as well, you know, maintaining a more indoor exposure for them rather than outdoor, even if they're outdoor pets. Those kinds of considerations should extend not just to ourselves, but outside to other people as well.
Oh, definitely. Now it seems like wildfire smoke events are becoming more common now. How should you mentioned a lot of things that folks do, but how do you think communities as a whole should prepare for these events?
The data is quite clear that we are going to see an increase in these events. And for us right now in the United States, what we are experiencing is the smoke, right, and the pollutants that come with it. We also have to consider that the smoke certainly is coming from a fire. And so certainly, you know, with the fires in Canada right now, we have to look at the root causes of why it is that disasters are actually on the increase, and not just quantitatively, meaning multiple disasters that are also compounding over time, but the frequency within which they are happening. In this case, when you also look at fires, we're seeing that fires, the data indicates that fires are starting to burn earlier, because fire season is fire season for a reason, right? Fires do burn at a specific time. However, what we have seen when you look at the data is that the fires are starting much earlier and ending much later. The other thing that we're seeing change is the intensity with which they're burning, right? So the intensity is that much higher, which means, therefore, that there's more destruction to the environment, there's more destruction to human lives and livelihoods. So addressing the root causes is really the responsibility of humanity. And I say humanity because here we are experiencing, you know, poor air quality. But when you really think about it, the challenge also lies more squarely on what is going on around globally in the weather patterns and how they are changing. In this case, the fires that are coming in from Canada, right? However, so not the fires coming in from Canada, but the smoke coming in from Canada. But we've also seen in the U.S. increased fires in longer burning seasons as well, and more extensive damage to public health. And what we also need to consider as well as the root causes is that the impacts of these events, which are now increasing, is also more long term, so that recovery does not happen as quickly as it previously used to happen. Okay. So by the time the next season comes along, you've barely recovered, whether it's on an individual level or up to macro level. The recovery period, so to speak, has really diminished. So increasingly, these outcomes are compound. So we need to address preparedness. We need to address mitigation. We need to certainly address response and recovery as well. And that's at a policy level, but also implementation, science, the research on it, the training of personnel, the collaboration across borders is also imperative.
Well, before we go, Doctor, is there anything else we have not touched on you want folks to know?
Certainly. I began to touch on this when I talked about communities that are sensitive. And we cannot highlight that enough, that looking at communities and the way that they are impacted by disasters is something that has to be considered as something that that is caused because of decisions that are made or ignored prior to disasters, right? So how much are we investing, not just financially, but the all dimensions of resources that need to be invested in preparing for disasters across the board really does need to be addressed. It's in how we live, how we're able to prepare. It's in the actions that we take, for example, asking our elected officials to pay attention to some of these changes. And it is calling upon, you know, community as well as the public-private partnerships to really participate collectively in addressing the challenges that exist, not just locally, but also in our region and across different continents as well, because they do affect us one way or another.
We were talking to Empire State University Assistant Professor of Emergency Management, Dr. Jyoti Mwaramba, discussing how smoke from the Canadian wildfires is affecting air quality across the United States, and especially here in New York right now, and what people can do to reduce their exposure and protect their health. Professor, thank you so much for joining us. I do really appreciate it.
Thank you, Patricio.
Still ahead, don't go anywhere. We'll hear from Sing Sing writer John J. Lennon about becoming a 2026 Guggenheim Fellow and why he says incarcerated writers deserve the same opportunities as anyone else. Stay tuned. It's Friday Local Edition, and I'm your host, Patricio Rubio. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Welcome back to The Local Edition on a Friday evening. John J. Lennon has spent years writing about his life inside prison, giving readers access to a world most journalists rarely get to see. Now the writer at Sing Sing Correctional Facility has received one of the country's most prestigious honors, a 2026 Guggenheim Fellowship in General Nonfiction. Lennon is believed to be the first person in the fellowship's 101-year history to receive this award while currently incarcerated. I had a chance to speak to him recently, along with Alex Duran of Galaxy Gives, about the significance of the fellowship and some of the barriers he faced and some of the barriers that other incarcerated writers are facing and why prison journalism matters. Here's my conversation with John. John, when you first learned that you received this Guggenheim Fellowship, what was your initial reaction?
Well, I mean, I was shocked. I called my friend Megan, who just worked for me, and she told me I have good news, and she told me I had won the Guggenheim, and you're just kind of stunned, and it's just a totally humbling experience. But whenever you sort of like win these kind of like things in here, it's also kind of a weird sort of cognitive dissonance, because you don't like sort of burst out of your cell and you're not like, guys, guess what, you know, it's, you kind of have to contain it, and you don't really tell many people. for several reasons. But yeah, so it was, yeah, it was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But also kind of a weird feeling too, if that makes sense.
Weird. Why? Can you elaborate that on that?
Yeah, because like it's an environment where it's weird. Sometimes I say that weird because you don't really want to, you're kind of, you use restraint with the good news you receive or like awards or validation, because you don't know the sort of feelings it'll drum up in the people, with people around you. You always want people to sort of like root for you, but you know, prison's a tough place. It's a tough environment and you can get a little paranoid. I've had some pretty gnarly situations where, I mean, look, you know, people, you know, I think there are some folks that really just genuinely, such is life, right? But the stakes are a little higher, right? Like in here, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Now, Alex, I want to talk to you a little, if you could tell us a little bit about what Galaxy Gives is all about, and why do you think this Johns Guggenheim Fellowship is significant, but, you know, just beyond the literary world here?
Yeah. So Galaxy Gives is a foundation. We're based in New York City. We give away about $20 million a year, mostly on criminal justice reform, but also on democracy, strengthening democracy issues across our nation. And I've been here 6 years leading our criminal justice reform work. And in 2022, John was awarded a Galaxy Leader Fellowship. He was the first incarcerated leader to do so. And I think, you know, the Guggenheim recognition is really important because there hasn't been kind of an acknowledgement of the brilliance, the beauty, the bravery that exists behind prison walls of incarcerated thinkers. And John is probably one of the most prolific writers in prison today. And we shouldn't make any distinction between people who are in prisons and people who are not. If you are a writer of that kind of caliber, I think you should just get the same opportunities as anybody else.
Yeah.
And when John, for example, applied for our fellowship, he didn't get a leg up. He went through the same process as hundreds of leaders across the country did. And he was able to stack up against the best of them. And he fared really well in our process. And he ultimately was awarded this fellowship, which carries a flexible grant, leadership development opportunities, convenings and gatherings that John is only able to attend when he calls in sometimes, and then support around folks' healing journey. I think that more foundations should look at the great resource and capacity that incarcerated people carry. And I think that, you know, we're in a place in this country right now where we're having a conversation about fascism and authoritarianism. But you ask anybody who's been incarcerated and they will tell you that authoritarianism was here before Trump was reelected president of the United States, right? Because I think that prisons operate as black boxes across this country. No journalist could go in there and report on it. So the work that John is doing is actually strengthening our democracy by reporting, bearing witness on what's happening behind prison walls.
Yeah. But do you think John's, you sort of answered a little bit there, but do you think John's recognition might shift like public understanding of prison punishment and rehabilitation?
Yeah, I think so. I think John's work is moving the needle on changing the narrative of who incarcerated people are and what they're capable of. And I think that, like I said, prisons don't only shield the public from the brutality that happens in there, but also from a lot of the brilliance that incarcerated people hold. And I think if we were to give people more opportunity and more recognition and bring in more sunlight into our prison system, we will see more writers, more artists, more people who are capable. We just don't give those people those chances, right? And John can speak to how he became a writer, but if we were to give more people those opportunities and actually believe in them and back them up with resources and healing opportunities, which the carceral state obviously doesn't do, I think we will have more equipped individuals coming home and being serving our society better.
Yeah. Now, John, when I spoke to you in the past, you've always described prison journalism, as giving you some kind of access that most reporters don't have. And how does being inside shape what you can see, what you can hear, and what you write about?
I think access is a sort of huge, important, you know, element of any storyteller. And I think when we think of ourselves as tellers on the inside, I think our mind may go to the things that we don't have. We don't have this, we don't have that, we don't have the technology, we don't have access to research. But what we do have is we do have something that most journalists, as you said, you know, would really like, at least temporarily. And that's the access of just like what's around us, right? It's like what Alex was talking about earlier when we called in, the cacophony of noises, the senses, everything. Like, and character drives stories. So I have access to some of, you know, like to the people around me. I mean, I'm usually in most of my stories, so it's usually my story. I try to relate to the experiences of the people that I write about. So if I'm writing about somebody that's suffering from mental illness, you know, I may not be schizophrenic, but I have been deeply depressed sometimes in my prison cell. And I think everyone can relate to that. So I'll try to hook into that. So it's that human, you know, shared kind of experience of what prison is like. But it's also just the story, you know, and it's the access to sort of tell these stories and have access to the action scenes, right? You know, so the best the reporter is going to get, if a reporter comes in here, is they're going to sit on the visit floor. That's a totally different dynamic than me telling the inaction story in the cell block, right? Or the yard, observing. So there's plenty of things that I encourage, you know, a lot of, you know, journalists that are on the inside. And I have to say, we're in a moment right now where it's like a renaissance of prison writing. And like just the infrastructure, the validation that places like that Galaxy gives, that, you know, has done recently with, you know, acknowledging not me, but just other incarcerated fellows who are also writers on the inside and artists. It's huge, right? And that's because we're in this space where people are producing work on the inside, publishing it, selling art to galleries. There's not many things we could do on the inside. Art is one of them. And, you know, these institutions that give these grants, we should be in the running too. So I encourage a lot of people on the inside to, you know, sort of like get in this space.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think folks like Alex who have been incarcerated and come out and now does like philanthropy work and is encouraging those incarcerated to express themselves and have these programs. And Alex, I what I sensed from you earlier was that there should be more of that. There should be more of those supporting those folks who are in prison to, you know, to express themselves and to hide that hidden talent there. Well, John, do you think receiving this fellowship can change how people inside the prison see your work or outside the prison see your work?
Look, I'm incredibly grateful for all the fellowships I've gotten, you know. I mean, I think the Guggenheim Fellowship is pretty cool, right? Because it's like, now they just did an article about like who gets the Guggenheim, like, you know, they were kind of like saying, oh, it's all the privileged professors at Harvard and Princeton. That's who gets the Guggenheim. It's all these people that are all in these areas, these special areas. And like, I was laughing. I was like, you know, and you got the, and then, you know, maybe they'll start being, you know, some people on the inside too, you know? So I guess like people are always sort of going to like gonna critique who gets the things and who, but as Alex was saying, and you know, I think what these places are showing is that it's about the work. And what I'm saying is we can do the work on the level.
You can find more on my conversation with John Jane Lennon on our website at WJFFradio.org. Actually, 35 minutes of this conversation. Go there and check it out. That does it for the local edition at this hour. Again, I'm Patricio Robayo. You've been listening to the local edition on Radio Catskill. Lucy, have a good night. Everyone else, take care of yourself. I'll talk to you soon.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.